Hi, welcome to The Jury Room, a true crime podcast. My name is Kevin, and I will be your host on this journey. We will be covering some of the most heinous, some of the most unthinkable, and some of the most monstrous crimes to ever be committed against humanity. We will be covering cannibalistic serial killers, decades-old unsolved mysteries, cold cases, missing person cases, and everything in between. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Please make sure you go subscribe and leave a review.
This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 58, Munchausen Syndrome by Proxy, Part 1. Most of us have heard of Munchausen Syndrome by Proxy thanks to its prevalence in popular culture, including TV, movies, books, and, of course, news articles. But what is it exactly? Is it a crime? A cry for help? A mental disorder? Or something else entirely? For the first time, to raise awareness of this insidious form of child abuse, I will cover Munchausen syndrome by proxy as a broad topic spanning several episodes instead of concentrating on one case. In part one of the series, I'll tell you what studies and experts have to say about this commonly misunderstood condition, and I'll also tell you the first part of the story of 5-year-old Garnett Spears. Garnett's death in January of 2014 was the culmination of 5 brutal years of unnecessary surgical procedures, medications, hospitalizations, induced illnesses, and gratuitous suffering at the hands of his mother, and the egregiousness of Garnett's story has made his one of the most well-known cases of Munchausen syndrome by proxy to date. This is part one of the baffling phenomenon of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. My sources for this episode were The Psychiatric Times, Munchausen.com, Medscape, The Healthy, the U.S. National Library of Medicine, the Official Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Springfield News Leader, Biography.com, People Magazine, the Journal News, Find a Grave, CBS's 48 Hours, Web of Lies on ID, Garnett's Journey Blog, Newsweek, USA Today, New York Daily News, Twitter, Chilling Crimes Blog, and the detailed, very well-researched book by John Glatt entitled My Sweet Angel, The True Story of Lacey Spears, the Seemingly Perfect Mother Who Murdered Her Son in Cold Blood. Before I get into the episode, I want to give a quick shout-out to a bunch of new patrons. Huge thank yous to Katie from the UK, Isabel from Fayetteville, Georgia, Desiree M., Kelly from Marengo, Illinois, Jennifer from Cape Charles, Virginia, and Debbie from Asheville, North Carolina. I can't thank you all enough for your support. Every pledge brings me closer to my goal to devote myself full-time to Suffer the Little Children. If you'd like to become a patron, the info is in the show notes for today's episode. Thank you so much to all my supporters. I'm sure most of you are at least somewhat familiar with Munchausen syndrome by proxy, or MSP. Many true crime podcasts have covered the baffling story of Gypsy Rose Blanchard, a young woman who is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence for the murder of her mother in the little pink house in Springfield, Missouri that was built for the pair by Habitat for Humanity. Claudinia D.D. Blanchard benefited financially and otherwise by falsifying her daughter's severe illnesses for most of Gypsy's life. She put Gypsy through multiple unnecessary surgical procedures, forced her to ingest a constant stream of medications she didn't need, lied about Gypsy's age, shaved her head to make people believe Gypsy suffered from leukemia, and even forced her to use a wheelchair when she was perfectly able to walk. Dee's abuse of her daughter began when Gypsy was a baby and continued into her adulthood, only coming to light in 2015 after Gypsy convinced her online boyfriend to stab Dee to death before the two went on the run and were arrested shortly thereafter. Gypsy's boyfriend, Nicholas Godejohn, was sentenced to life in prison. After pleading guilty to second-degree murder, Gypsy was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Now 29 years old, she's planning to write a book about her lifelong battle with medical child abuse with the hope of helping other children, and she's looking forward to being paroled, possibly as early as December of 2023. While I obviously don't condone murder as the solution to any problem, I will honestly celebrate when I hear the news that Gypsy has been released from prison. Her story has fascinated me, and most of the world, since it first broke in 2015. It's one of the most horrific cases of long-term child abuse I've ever heard, and I would absolutely do a deep dive into Gypsy's story if it hadn't already been comprehensively covered by multiple true crime podcasts, TV shows, books, an HBO documentary called Mommy, Dead, and Dearest, and even an 8-part Hulu original series entitled The Act. For this series, I'll be focusing on other cases of suspected Munchausen by proxy, some more well-known than others. There are surprisingly few well-documented cases that fall under this umbrella. The story I'll be telling you in today's episode may be the most well-known MSP case next to Gypsy's, and it has also been covered by multiple outlets, but once I started digging into the case, I simply couldn't stop. There's so much information available about it that the story of Garnet Spears will actually encompass both parts 1 and 2 of the series. And fair warning, Garnet's story is a brutal one, and it really hit me hard. The topic of MSP itself is a major rabbit hole. In my research, I was hoping to come to a solid conclusion about whether MSP is a mental illness or just plain child abuse. Spoiler alert, there is no solid conclusion to be had, at least at this point, although there have been multiple studies and reports on the subject. It may even come down to a decision made on a case-by-case basis. I'll let you decide. Let me preface this by unequivocally stating that I am not a doctor or in any way an expert in this field. All of the details I'm going to provide you about this topic come from other sources, including experts, but any opinions presented are my own. Munchausen syndrome by proxy is not, in fact, a psychiatric diagnosis in and of itself. Also known as medical child abuse, this pattern of behavior actually falls under a psychiatric condition listed in the DSM-5 called Factitious Disorder Imposed on Another, or FDIA. A 2014 article in the Psychiatric Times stated, "More than a decade ago, an American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children task force recommended professionals separate the concepts of child maltreatment and psychopathology when discussing, evaluating, or treating Munchausen by proxy, MSP. Although not a formal medical or psychiatric diagnosis, MSP refers to abusive illness falsification that is due to factitious disorder imposed on another, FDIA, in the abuser. FDIA is the DSM-5 psychiatric disorder that describes individuals who persistently falsify illness in another even when there is little or nothing tangible for them to gain from the behavior." Because the term Munchausen by proxy is commonly used among the general public, I've chosen to use both medical child abuse and MSP to describe this type of child abuse. The name Munchausen syndrome by proxy was inspired by a fictional German nobleman in a 1785 book titled Baron Munchausen's Narrative of His Marvelous Travels and Campaigns in Russia. The character was known for telling impossible tales about his travels and achievements, which included riding on a cannonball, traveling to the moon, and riding a 40-foot crocodile. His propensity for lying and embellishing the truth beyond recognition was the inspiration for the names for 3 factitious disorders: Munchausen syndrome, in which a patient lies about their own medical history and conditions; Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which I'll be discussing today; and the more recently coined Munchausen by internet, in which the patient fakes their own illness to gain sympathy or other benefit from an online audience. There are no reliable statistics available on the prevalence of FDIA, but all sources indicate that in the majority of cases, the adult imposing illness on their child proxy is the mother. Victims are more or less equally divided between girls and boys. It's estimated that approximately 625 cases of poisoning and suffocation caused by FDIA occur in the United States each year, although most are never attributed as such. Most sources report a mortality rate for victims of MSP between 9 to 10%, making it one of the most lethal forms of child abuse. Author Andrea Dunlop has personal experience in the world of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, growing up with a family member who would ultimately display this pattern of behavior to the detriment of her own child. Andrea's most recent novel, We Came Here to Forget, tackled the topic of a family torn apart by MSP. When interviewed about the topic by People magazine, Andrea said,
"It's incredibly isolating, which makes people think it's incredibly rare. I believe it's underreported. Most perpetrators are never convicted and never end up with their kids taken away.
Dr. Mark Feldman is a leading international expert in factitious disorders who has written multiple books and more than 100 peer-reviewed articles in the professional literature on the subject. Dr. Feldman is a clinical professor of psychiatry, an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, and a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and his work has been the subject of stories and articles in over 200 magazines and newspapers. He's also appeared on countless TV and radio programs over the years to discuss these disorders in general or certain cases in particular, including gypsies and garnets. During my research, his name came up absolutely everywhere I looked, and I'm so impressed with his work and his credentials that I'll include a link in the show notes to his bio on the Munchausen.com website. Dr. Feldman told People magazine,
"Most cases are never recognized. Instead, the child undergoes years of suffering without any doctor, relative, or friend ever realizing that the mother herself is the reason the child is so sick. It is not nearly as rare as many people think."
In cases of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, or MSP, a caregiver falsifies a child's symptoms whether or not the illness is legitimate. The induction of the illness is not necessary for the behavior to be classified as Munchausen by proxy, although induction can be part of it. In other words, a child victim of this type of abuse may or may not have an underlying medical diagnosis. By far, most of the victims of MSP are young children, and the caregiver's abusive behavior often manifests when the child is pre-verbal. Even in children old enough to speak, most usually don't tell for a variety of reasons. For one thing, most of these children believe what the abuser has told them about their condition, so they have no reason to speak out. Even if they know they're not as sick as their caregiver makes it appear, or that their caregiver is causing their illness, most child victims won't say anything out of fear or loyalty to their abuser, and some even play along with the charade for the same reasons. I compiled a list of some of the most common MSP behaviors a caregiver might exhibit, including compulsive lying, taking a child for excessive doctor or hospital visits, doctor shopping or hospital hopping, the inability or unwillingness to produce the child's medical records to new providers, putting the child on multiple medications for a variety of health conditions, insisting on a feeding tube or a central venous catheter being inserted into the child or requesting other unnecessary medical procedures, being incredibly well-versed in the child's supposed medical conditions, even to an inappropriate degree, isolating the child from other family members or friends, frequently moving from one region to another, maintaining an inappropriate level of control over the child, such as not allowing the child to speak freely or be alone with other people, cutting the child off from the outside world by restricting access to communication devices such as phones and computers, causing the child to become malnourished due to a severely restricted diet, having a child frequently examined for sexual abuse without any evidence of such taking place, repeatedly suffocating a child to cause the appearance of apnea, causing bruises or other physical injuries to present to medical professionals as symptoms of a condition, reporting symptoms in the child that do not present when the child is monitored by medical professionals, or introducing foreign substances or elements into a child's body in any number of ways in order to cause illness or skew lab results. One particularly vexing question is, what causes a caregiver to behave this way? Looking for the why behind the behavior of MSP left me with more questions than answers. No two perpetrators are the same, and clinicians don't know what actually causes Munchausen syndrome by proxy to manifest in a caregiver, although the comorbidity of other psychiatric disorders with FDIA can't be ignored. FDIA is often comorbid with narcissistic, antisocial, and borderline personality traits or disorders, as well as somatic symptom disorder, illness anxiety disorder, factitious disorder imposed on self, pathological lying, and depression. As for reasons a caregiver might decide to impose or amplify illness in a child victim, as far as I can tell, the need for attention appears to be universal. These abusers seem drawn to drama like moths to flame. As you'll hear when I get into some of the case examples, many of the perpetrators have lifelong histories of lying, embellishing, and fabricating improbably dramatic events in their own lives, even prior to the child abuse that landed them on this podcast. The advent of the internet, and especially social media and its instant gratification, has only made Munchausen and MBP behaviors more prevalent, hence the pattern of behavior now known as Munchausen by internet, a phrase Dr. Feldman coined in 2000. It's all too easy to hop online, make up a story about having cancer or some other disease, and immediately be inundated with sympathetic responses feeding the person's need for attention. Dr. Feldman said of the behavior,
"All that's involved is clicking into a support group, and they find they can get a tremendous amount of sympathy and nurturing. It's a conduit to an enormous audience."
Doctors who suspect a parent of medical child abuse can and often do check the parent's social media accounts, looking for any indication the parent may be exaggerating or misrepresenting the child's medical problems. One of the most insidious parts of MSP is that these abusive behaviors can go on for years without detection. People with factitious disorders have the innate and terrifying ability to manipulate and mislead doctors, medical professionals, and even mental health clinicians. They are very good at making even the most astute providers believe them. According to Dr. Feldman, some of the signs and symptoms of FDIA can include
problems that are unexplainable, persistent, or resistant to interventions that should work after adequate evaluation and treatment attempts. Serious discrepancies among the history, clinical findings, and patient's general presentation. A working diagnosis of a disorder so rare that maltreatment is more likely. Symptoms and signs that occur only in association with one person and or schedule, for example, weekly or monthly, or in the absence of a family member, for example, whenever one parent goes on a business trip. A caregiver who reports that records are missing or who insists on hand-carrying them without adequate reason. Families in which other members have had problems similar to the patient's presenting problem without adequate explanation. A caregiver who habitually relates dramatic, exaggerated, or improbable events in relation to her or himself or others. A caregiver with previous medical or nursing experience, an extensive history of illness, or a history of factitious disorder. Other members of the treatment team are suspicious.
The question I really wanted answered during my research was whether or not a caregiver exhibiting signs of MSP or FDIA should or even can be held responsible for their behaviors. And the closest I came to finding that answer was this quote from Dr. Feldman, who said,
FDIA is not a psychosis. The caretaker voluntarily and consciously simulates, falsely reports, and/or induces symptoms of a problem, and then takes the victim to seek professional attention, disavowing knowledge of the source of the problem. The deception may arise from a desire for attention, anger, a need for control over others, or other intangible motivations. Note that if the primary motivation appears to be material gain, for example, receipt of money for a disabled person, the principal diagnosis is malingering. However, in many cases of FDIA, there is a tangible gain that appears to be secondary to the non-tangible gain. FDIA and malingering are not mutually exclusive.
Malingering is not considered a mental disorder or psychological condition either. It, too, is an act or a series of behaviors. Malingering is faking or exaggerating a physical or mental illness for the individual's benefit, including avoiding work, military service or other responsibilities, obtaining drugs, avoiding the ramifications of the law, seeking attention, getting time off from school or paid time off from work, receiving charity, government benefits, or other financial rewards, among many others. Like FDIA, malingering is closely associated with diagnosable psychological conditions, such as antisocial personality disorder or histrionic personality traits. Fortunately, not all cases of MSP end in the death of a child. Typically, if it's even recognized at all, when intervention is made in one of these cases, parental rights are terminated and the parent may be placed on probation. Despite the potential deadliness of MSP, these abusers rarely get jail time for their abuse. The victim may not even realize what happened until much later, once they're out of that environment. It's exceptionally painful for a child victim when this occurs because, first, they've lost at least one parent or otherwise been separated from their family, which is incredibly painful for a child. And second, they often have to come to terms with the fact that their caregiver was likely lying to and abusing them for years, if not their entire life. I can't begin to imagine how much trauma this must cause or how much therapy would be necessary to overcome it. I want to wrap this section up with a quote from Dr. Feldman, who emphasizes that Munchausen syndrome by proxy is not a mental illness, but a form of maltreatment, and it should therefore be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
The problem in the field has been that these mothers tend to get slaps on the wrist rather than serious or any jail time because it is assumed that they are victims of a serious mental disorder. This is rarely true.
Now, with those questions answered to the best of my ability, let me tell you the story of a gorgeous 5-year-old boy with long, blonde hair, blue eyes, and an infectious, gap-toothed grin named Garnet Spears, whose life was cut short by his own mother's selfish need for attention. Lacey Elizabeth Spears was born on October 16, 1987, the youngest of three children born to Terry and Tina Spears. Lacey was raised in Decatur, Alabama, where she graduated from Decatur High School in 2006. According to multiple friends and family members, even from a young age, Lacey was known to tell tall tales and reveled in drama, attention, and sympathy. Throughout her childhood and teenage years, she faked illnesses, injuries, sexual assaults, molestation, eating disorders, and even pregnancies, once going so far as to have a friend schedule an appointment for an abortion after claiming she became pregnant by a family member who molested her. It should come as no surprise that when the friend arrived to pick Lacey up for the appointment, she breezily claimed it was no longer necessary, as she had just had a convenient miscarriage. Lacey's exorbitant lies nearly led to a makeshift intervention by friends who planned the confrontation with the help of their church youth pastor, who called off the intervention after a conversation with Lacey's mother. By all accounts, Lacey always wanted to be a mother and adored children. As a little girl, she was obsessed with her collection of American Girl dolls and fussed over them like they were her own children. By the time Lacey graduated from high school in 2006, she had never dated much, spending her high school years working hard for the best possible grades while seeking the approval and adoration of her teachers. She began working in childcare, where some parents later said she was very clingy, spent too much time with their children, and became so involved in their families that it made them uncomfortable. Three women later came forward to report that Lacey had unfettered access to their children, who subsequently developed health issues, including severe, recurrent ear infections. After Lacey's care of these children was suspended, in each case, their medical issues disappeared. One of these children was baby John John, who Lacey babysat free of charge for his mother, Autumn Hunt, a former co-worker at Jack's Burger Place in Decatur. At the time, Lacey worked at the daycare center John John attended, and she would sometimes take him home with her after work, often watching him on weekends and overnights. Lacey was obsessed with the baby, so much so that she took over 300 photos of him and posted them on her MySpace profile. Almost every single photo had a caption, and some of them were downright creepy, labeling one photo of John John,
"My world, my everything,"
another,
"Hey there, Mommy Lacey,"
and yet another,
"He completes me."
One photo of Lacey kissing John John on the lips was captioned,
"A mother's love is unexplainable."
That's correct. Lacey allowed her online friends to believe that John John was her own child. In a comment under one photo of the adorable little boy with distinctive curly blonde hair, a friend wrote,
"He's so cute. Is he yours?"
Lacey replied,
"Yes, he is. That's the love of my life. He was born February 14th.
This led to a confrontation with the baby's mother, Autumn, who told Lacey she had gone too far and backed out of the free babysitting deal, leaving 20-year-old Lacey in tears. Before she pulled that stunt with John John, Lacey, fresh out of high school, babysat another little boy named Cameron, making herself indispensable to Cameron's mother, Christy Burnham. She drove Christy and her 10-month-old son around, even obtaining baby items for her own home, including diapers, a car seat, clothing, and even a crib. Christy later said,
"I think she wanted a baby, and I think she was desperate. I know my kid's adorable, but I don't think it was personally Cameron or later John John. I think it was anybody that needed help she would offer. It would seem innocent and loving as she'd offer her hand, trying to be like your friend. But then in the end, I don't know. Something's wrong with her. She was like jealous."
One day, Christy was out with her son when, she said,
"Someone came up to me and said, 'Oh, you're watching Lacey's baby.' I was like, 'That's not Lacey's baby. That's Cameron. That's my baby.' She was telling people that it was her son."
Cameron was one child in Lacey's care who developed recurring ear infections. Lacey's obsession with Cameron came to an abrupt end after one weekend when Christy was unable to track down Lacey and the baby until the following Monday. When Lacey finally returned Cameron to his mother, Christy told Lacey she would never watch her son again. Lacey broke down in tears. When she was about 20, Lacey began sleeping with a young man named Chris Hill, a garage door installer who lived in the apartment downstairs from the two-bedroom unit she shared with her sister, Rebecca, in the Cedar Key Apartments in Decatur. Initially, Chris had no interest in the young woman he and his friends made fun of, calling her the predator. Lacey, he said, would pass his apartment without expression.
"She was quiet. You'd really have to stop her. Say, hey, 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 for her to talk to you. She was cold or just very antisocial. Another breed altogether, like nothing I've ever dealt with before."
Their undefined relationship began when, one day, Lacey visited Chris's apartment to ask if he would put together a crib for her to use when baby John John spent the night. As Chris put together the crib, the two began talking.
"I think she was lonely. I just figured she needed some attention."
After that, he said,
"We hooked up for a little while."
Their relationship, which lasted a few months, might best be defined as
neighbors with benefits,
as Chris put it. Chris later claimed Lacey never once brought up the subject of birth control, and he never pushed it. By the age of 20, Lacey was pregnant, at which point they began talking about getting serious, even discussing marriage. Suddenly, though, Lacey broke things off with Chris, and before long, she told him the unborn baby wasn't his after all. Chris later said,
"All of a sudden, she just acted like I didn't exist. She just ended it. She just wanted to be a mother and not have a father involved."
Garnet Paul Thompson Spears was born in Huntsville Hospital on December 3, 2008, weighing 6 pounds, 14 ounces. In his birth announcement in the Decatur Daily newspaper, no father was mentioned. Even though Lacey and Garnet lived just upstairs, Chris never met his son.
"We had already split up, and she was saying he wasn't mine and to leave her alone. I only saw her and him when she would get out of her car to walk upstairs. I would hear her car door shut and hear him cry. Then I would look out of my window to try and get a look at him."
Lacey, in fact, warned Chris that if he didn't stay away, she'd call the police. It was only later, after she and Garnet had moved from Alabama to Florida, that Lacey started telling anyone who would listen that Garnet's father was a man she called Daddy Blake, who she described as a hero police officer who was supposedly born on July 1, 1986, and died in a car accident in late 2011. On a blog she created titled Garnet's Journey, which still exists but consists of only two posts, Lacey wrote on September 18, 2012,
"We have together survived nearly 365 days, a complete year without Blake, my soulmate and Garnet's daddy. The past year has been the hardest year of my life."
From late 2009 through early 2010, while still living in Decatur, Lacey posted constantly on her Twitter account, at Garnet's Mommy, where she constantly and repetitively chronicled her love for her son, who she referred to both as
my little prince
and by his full hyphenated first name, Garnet Paul. Later, she would also refer to him as
Garnet the Great.
Also mentioned multiple times in Lacey's tweets was a friend named Ginger, later revealed to be Ginger Dabbs Anderson, who had been Garnet's nurse during one of his early hospitalizations and had befriended Lacey, often having Lacey and Garnet over to her house at the time. Much later, Ginger was bewildered to read the stories online about Lacey's supposed soulmate, Blake.
"She was over here, and I never saw anybody named Blake or whatever his name was. I think it was a made-up picture, a fabricated situation. That was not even his daddy. His daddy, I met him. He lives in Decatur. Chris."
Another person who knew Lacey in Decatur was Riley Vaughn, who told USA Today that she never met this so-called Blake, noting that he also did not appear in any photos from Garnet's early life, even though he was supposedly a huge part of it and despite Lacey's propensity for taking a vast multitude of photos. Riley said,
"She was crying about him on Facebook posts, saying he was the love of her life, that he was always there for her. That's why I stopped Facebooking her. I was just done with her after that, after realizing that most of the stuff she was saying just wasn't true."
The Blake story was one of many fabrications Lacey would create to drum up sympathy from her online admirers. It would definitely not be the only one. Are you searching for a true crime podcast covering lesser-known cases involving military personnel, veterans, family members, and others associated with the military? On the Military True Crime Addict podcast, host David Kokish relates real true crime stories that the news media hasn't reported on, although when you hear these stories, you'll definitely wonder why. David deep dives crimes involving assault, harassment, hate crimes, abuse of power, murder, PTSD, hazing, rape, and other crimes committed by or against members of the military, veterans, and their extended families. On the Military True Crime Addict, David gives voices to the victims of these crimes and fights to raise awareness for those impacted by them. You don't need knowledge of the military to enjoy this podcast. If you enjoy hearing detailed true crime stories, the Military True Crime Addict podcast is for you. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. With all the video conferencing and virtual meetings going on these days, we all want to look our best. If you're like me, you're probably confused by all the different methods of teeth whitening on the market. Now that I'm partnering with Smile Brilliant, I've learned a few things that you might find helpful about home teeth whitening methods. For example, LED lights are a novelty item. Whitening strips neglect the gum lines, crevices, and molars. Charcoal is abrasive and wears down your enamel. And whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains. So if none of these miracle products really works, what does? The number one product recommended by dentists is the custom-fitted tray, which usually costs an arm and a leg because they require a dentist to make them by hand using a model of your teeth. With Smile Brilliant's Lab Direct process, you can get custom-fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price without a single visit to the dentist. Using an exact model of your teeth, Smile Brilliant's lab technicians will handcraft your trays to give you the best possible whitening results. All you have to do is visit smilebrilliant.com, and when you order their system, make sure you use the coupon code CHILDREN at checkout for 30% off. When you receive the package from Smile Brilliant, it's really simple. You just make your dental impressions at home and return them using the prepaid envelope they provide you. In a matter of 1 week, Smile Brilliant will have your trays back in the mail. Using my coupon code, CHILDREN, means you're supporting me while saving a huge amount of money, So check out smilebrilliant.com today. As soon as Garnet was born, he and Lacey became fixtures in the pediatrician's office and hospital emergency room. Lacey repeatedly reported the baby suffered from ear infections so severe they leaked blood and pus, and she insisted he wouldn't take a bottle, and when he did, he couldn't keep anything down. Garnet was soon diagnosed with failure to thrive, and although doctors could not determine why Garnet couldn't keep food down, they performed a surgical procedure called a Nissen funduplication on his stomach to make it impossible for him to vomit. The procedure, according to Lacey, did nothing to help Garnet, who she said continued to throw up. At this point, Lacey's flair for drama, need for attention, and propensity for lies converged as she gravitated to social media to attract a sympathetic following to eat up her stories of her helpless baby's many medical afflictions and, of course, her tireless efforts to care for him like the perfect mother she portrayed herself to be. Lacey's patient, long-suffering maternal facade on social media sites, including MySpace, Twitter, and no fewer than 3 Facebook accounts with different audiences and privacy settings for each, became her identity. She posted constantly, even obsessively, about her son. Her Twitter account proclaimed her to be the
21-year-old single mother to a little prince named Garnet Paul,
and she posted such statements as,
"My son is my everything. I love him so much."
And,
"At work with my little prince, then headed home to clean and play with Garnet Paul. It's going to be a great day."
At the time, Lacey was still working in childcare, where she was permitted to bring her son with her. A report released years later revealed that when Garnet was 5 weeks old, Lacey
verbalized that she wanted to harm
him and was referred a month later to
Medical Social Services for interpersonal conflict, stress, and dysfunction.
During his first year of life, Garnet was admitted to the hospital no fewer than 23 times. No matter how many tests doctors ran, they couldn't determine what was causing Garnet's mysterious health issues. In February of 2009, Garnet was admitted to the hospital with severe dehydration, experiencing seizures. Tests determined that Garnet had a dangerously high level of sodium in his blood. The normal range for a baby is between 130 and 150 millimoles per liter. At the time of this hospitalization, Garnet's level was 166. High levels of sodium can cause seizures or even death. Dr. Robert Pass, who treated Garnet during his stay, was unable to explain why or how the infant's sodium level became as high as it did, despite multiple tests being run, including an MRI, a CAT scan, an EEG, a chest X-ray, and a swallowing study, all of which returned normal results. Garnet was treated with IV fluids to bring his sodium level down gradually, as a rapid decrease could cause brain damage. It was during this time that Ginger Dabbs Anderson met Lacey and Garnet and became sympathetic to their plight. Ginger, as well as other hospital staff, grew concerned about Lacey's claims that Garnet couldn't keep food down because the nurses themselves had no problem whatsoever giving Garnet a bottle. Even so, Lacey managed to convince a surgeon to perform on her infant son a Nissen funduplication, which is a surgical procedure that makes it impossible for the recipient to vomit. In June of 2009, when Garnet was 6 months old, Lacey brought him to Decatur General Hospital, bleeding from his eyes, nose, mouth, and ears, and suffering seizures so severe he actually coded and had to be revived. Garnet was airlifted to the Children's Hospital of Alabama in Birmingham. This hospitalization led to a call to the Alabama Department of Human Resources, although there was no follow-up by DHR because, according to department spokesman Barry Spear, hospital officials in both Decatur and Birmingham did not report any suspected abuse or neglect. In situations like that, the spokesman explained, DHR would not open a case, but instead would offer support services and would not open a file for the family. By this time, Lacey was trying to convince hospital staff that Garnet needed a feeding tube implanted, but she was rebuffed by doctors who insisted it was not necessary. Not getting what she wanted, Lacey tried another facility where she managed to talk a doctor into implanting a feeding tube, or G-tube, when Garnet was 9 months old. A feeding tube is an opening in the child's abdomen where nutrients are administered in liquid form, either via hanging bag, bottle, or syringe. At that point, Lacey could directly inject any liquid she wanted into Garnet's stomach, and he was physically unable to throw it up. For obvious reasons, feeding tubes tend to be a common theme among many cases of MSP. Dr. Feldman, who I mentioned earlier, told the Journal News,
"That's an avenue for medical chaos. A feeding tube is a real red flag."
Ginger Dabbs Anderson, the nurse who cared for Garnet in the hospital, was concerned by the number and severity of Garnet's ear infections.
"He was getting ear infections a lot. Bad, terrible ear infections. I felt suspicious about that. I didn't understand how he was getting ear infections like that. He even had staph infections in his ear."
Ginger ended up befriending Lacey to help her better care for Garnet.
She didn't know how to be a mother. That's the only reason I was friends with her, because I thought I could teach her how to mother Garnet, what to do for him, and how to love him and take care of him.
Ginger later told police she witnessed an incident in which Lacey lost her temper with Garnet while giving him a bath and forced his head underwater.
She held him down in the water because she was flustered with him, upset with him, because he was whining when she was washing his hair. I mean, she was pouring water on his head. A baby is going to do that. I jumped on her. I made her stop and got him out. I got him dressed and I took him with me.
Considering the incident a brief loss of temper, Ginger did not report it to either DHR or the police. She later said she wished she had done more to help the little boy she affectionately called G, and he called her the same in return. Online, Lacey admitted to a startling act of child abuse, framing herself as a repentant mother who lost her cool. She wrote on one of her Facebook pages, which she called Happy Hippie Mama, that she lost her temper with Garnet in the bathtub when he touched the faucet despite her telling him not to. He screamed, she screamed back, and then, Lacey said, she ran the tub full of cold water with him standing in it, forcing him to take a freezing cold bath. In the post, Lacey wrote that she felt awful and hoped she could be forgiven. The army of online supporters she had amassed offered nothing but support and comforting words, and Lacey lapped it all up like a thirsty dog. The only problem was, her thirst for attention was unquenchable, and Garnet would pay the ultimate price for it. In early 2011, saying she wanted to give Garnet a better life, Lacey made the decision to move from her hometown of Decatur, Alabama, to Clearwater, Florida, where she and Garnet would live with Lacey's grandmother, Peggy Florence, in her modest suburban home. While living in Florida to support herself and Garnet, Lacey babysat, cleaned houses, and received public assistance. In her free time, she joined parenting groups, where she found the attention she craved in the form of parents who comforted and sympathized with her as she told them tearful stories of her son's maladies and her fiancé's death. Lacey soon became good friends with the woman who lived across the street from her grandmother's house. The woman, whose name was Kim Phillipson, noticed that Lacey was often outside playing with Garnet, but when her parents frequently visited, she remained inside the house while her father was outside with the boy. Eventually, Lacey told Kim that her father, Terry, regularly sexually abused her, and it had been going on for a long time. In fact, Lacey said, swearing Kim to secrecy, that Terry was actually Garnet's father, and her mother, Tina, knew about it. Kim was shocked, of course. In her mind, this revelation may have explained Garnet's multitude of health issues. As the months ticked by and Lacey continued behaving as if terrified when her parents visited, Kim became determined to put a stop to it, storming across the street to confront Lacey's mother and telling Tina that she and Terry needed to leave immediately. Lacey later came over to Kim's house, begging her to apologize. Baffled, Kim crossed the street to talk with Lacey's grandma, Peggy, who explained to her that
Lacey has a truthfulness issue.
After that, Kim cut off contact with Lacey and her family. In June of 2011, Florida's Department of Children and Families began an investigation into Lacey after receiving complaints that she was medically neglecting and physically abusing then-2-year-old Garnet. The complaint stated,
"Mom will slap him for no reason as hard as she can. He begins to cry, and then she begins to love on him."
The document also alleged that Lacey took Garnet swimming with his eyes and ears bleeding, as well as taking him on outings with high-grade fevers. The agency found no marks or bruising on Garnet, and Lacey, of course, denied all allegations of abuse and neglect. When their investigation was complete, DCF classified Garnet as being at
intermediate risk
because of his age and medical history, but even so, they closed the case with no follow-up ordered. That summer, Garnet's dog, Odie, was found dead in the yard by unknown means. Lacey told some people the dog drowned in the bathtub, while she told others he ate a poison frog, which neighbors found curious, as they had kept pets for years in the same area with no such accidents occurring. In August of 2011, DCF received another complaint about Lacey when a member of her attachment parenting group, concerned that Garnet wasn't getting proper care, reported that the almost 3-year-old boy had recently lost weight and that his mother wasn't following through with the recommendations of doctors. As it turned out, Lacey had recently turned her back on Western medicine, leaning more toward a holistic approach. She told the investigating agency that Garnet mainly ate by mouth, but she fed him herbs through his stomach tube. She told him that she and Garnet were vegan and that her son's diet was 85% vegetables and 15% fruit. DCF concluded in its report,
"A medical records review was conducted and it was determined that there are positive findings for medical neglect."
However, again, the investigation was closed anyway after it was determined Lacey was evidently following through with some doctor appointments. Friend Riley Vaughn from Decatur later told a reporter,
All of a sudden, she was talking about when Garnet was sick, she didn't believe in antibiotics, she didn't want to take him to a doctor, that she believed in holistic medicine. You could kind of tell she wasn't getting him the help he needed if he really was as sick as she claimed he was.
By the following summer, Lacey had apparently had enough of being questioned about her parenting style. On June 28, 2012, she made a fiery Facebook post defending her parenting choices that garnered 32 likes and multiple supportive comments. The post read,
"No, my child does not eat off plastic, have his food cooked in a microwave, play with plastic toys that light up and talk. He isn't vaccinated, doesn't follow Western medicine. No, I won't take his pacifier until he is ready to let it go. At the end of the day, he is loved, nurtured, thriving, happy, and always put first."
Then, as is common among MSP perpetrators, Lacey began looking for a new place for her and Garnet to settle, as far away from the suspicions of doctors and neighbors as possible. That new place, hundreds of miles away from Clearwater, Florida, would end up being Garnet's last. In November of 2012, Lacey and Garnet, by then almost 4 years old, packed up their car and drove north to their new home in Chestnut Ridge, New York, where Lacey knew literally no one. Lacey had applied and been hired for a job caring for elders at the Fellowship Community, an alternative nonprofit residential community whose focus is back-to-earth living and whose residents live off the land and garden organic produce. The organization's website touts it as
an intergenerational care community.
Within the Fellowship Community, about 70 elderly people, called members, paid for the privilege of living there. The other 60 or so residents of the community were called co-workers and were there to support and care for them, as well as to perform any other necessary duties. Lacey had been hired as a caretaker for the elderly members, and she and Garnet were placed in an apartment on the ground floor of Tulip House, a split-level house in the woods containing several apartments. The community did not believe in locks, so there was little privacy to be had, which at first took Lacey aback. It seems she quickly learned to adapt, using the quirk to her advantage by evidently sneaking into other residents' apartments and relieving them of some of their possessions. Not long after they moved in, Lacey was accused of stealing clothing and other items from her neighbor, Christine O'Brien, who later saw the comforter from her own bed in Lacey's bedroom. The leaders of the community told Christine to let it go. For some reason, they seemed keen to protect Lacey right from the start. As usual, Lacey's dramatic life story, which she shared with anyone and everyone as often as possible, had won the hearts of those around her. As for Garnet, he immediately became a beloved fixture in the community. Everyone adored him, and everyone shared in caring for and watching him. He made friends with both adults and elders, who later said Garnet never failed to ask for the name of every new person he met, and then remembered their name when he saw them again. One resident later testified that Garnet
basically became the little mayor
of the community. By the time they arrived in New York, Lacey's story about Blake was fully formed, and she would tell her tragic story to absolutely anyone who would listen. Now she said Blake had been her high school sweetheart, although the friends she grew up with in Decatur had never met or seen him, and some of them even knew Chris Hill, Garnet's actual father. Lacey told people she and Blake had suffered 2 miscarriages and given birth to a stillborn baby prior to Garnet's birth. When Blake died, Lacey insisted, they were engaged. She even wore a diamond ring she said he had given her. Probably worst of all, she convinced Garnet that his Daddy Blake had been reincarnated as an owl, and she filled their apartment with owl-themed decorations. Everyone had seen the owl motif, but what no one had seen were photos of Blake, which they found exceedingly odd. The only photo anyone had ever seen of the fabled Blake later turned out to be a stock photo. Lacey also told people various stories about Blake's death. Some heard he was involved in a car accident. Others were told he was killed on duty. For some, it was a motorcycle accident, and for others still, he was hit by a car. Keeping her lies straight must have felt like a full-time job for Lacey at that point. As Judge Judy tends to say, if you tell the truth, you don't have to have a good memory. In April of 2013, Lacey accused a man at the Fellowship of exposing himself to her. Ramapo police responded, the man denied Lacey's story, and another resident said she did not witness anything. Lacey declined to file a formal complaint, and it is unknown if there is any truth whatsoever to her accusation. In September of that year, Garnet started kindergarten at the Waldorf School. Waldorf education is based on the philosophies of Rudolf Steiner, the founder of Anthroposophy, and, according to Wikipedia,
strives to develop pupils' intellectual, artistic, and practical skills in an integrated and holistic manner.
Lacey would report that Garnet had a hard time with school, didn't want to go, and had trouble separating from her. By all other accounts, however, including his teacher, Carol Greeter, Garnet absolutely loved school. He eagerly participated in all of the classroom activities, made friends easily, and was a joy to have in class. The following month, Lacey reported sexual harassment by another man to the executive circle of the fellowship. Unbelievably, the man and his wife were asked to leave without even being given the chance to defend themselves. They ended up moving to Brazil. At the fellowship, community members would have had no idea Garnet was sick if not for Lacey's constant stories about it. He seemed healthy, happy, and energetic, running around and playing without any signs of illness. Lacey reported she had to get up once or twice a night to feed him through his feeding tube because he didn't get the same nutrients everyone else did. Residents were baffled because they witnessed Garnet have a perfectly healthy appetite and eat just fine in the community dining hall. He would eat absolutely anything anyone put in front of him with seemingly no gastric ramifications. In fact, in 2013, pediatric gastroenterologist Dr. Ivan Derenkov from Middletown, New York, was concerned that Garnet's feeding tube was in place for so long, especially because Garnet seemed perfectly healthy and happy with a good appetite. He said the medical history Lacey provided was scant, and when he pressed her for information about the tube and for Garnet's medical records, she never provided either.
I couldn't get the information. I never got the records about his first surgery when the G-tube was put in. I did my own investigation and found no medical reason for his eating problems.
Lacey told the doctor that she continued to use the G-tube to provide Garnet with liquid nutrition overnight, even though three of her friends and Garnet's teacher all later testified that Garnet had a good appetite and ate normally in their care, tearing through cheeseburgers and fries, mashed potatoes, fried okra, and all other kinds of real food. Dr. Mark Feldman, the Munchausen by proxy expert, who was never involved in Lacey's case, explained why Dr. Derenkov may have found Lacey less than forthcoming with Garnet's medical records, saying,
"It's another red flag if the mother offers lots of different explanations for the absence of permission to access records. You have to wonder if she's concealing something."
In Gypsy Blanchard's case, her mother, Dee Dee, told doctors in Missouri that Gypsy's medical records had been destroyed during Hurricane Katrina. Dr. Derenkov said Lacey eagerly agreed to Garnet going under general anesthesia to have an endoscopy and a biopsy to determine if he had celiac disease, but she didn't follow up when he recommended, at 5 appointments in a row, that Garnet undergo a nutritional and feeding evaluation to see if the feeding tube was even necessary. She was fine with an invasive and painful procedure, as long as it didn't mean she'd lose her tried-and-true method of pumping whatever she wanted directly into her son's stomach. Within a 2-year period, Lacey took Garnet to over 20 doctor's offices. She repeatedly told new providers that Garnet suffered from various medical conditions, like Crohn's and celiac diseases, neglecting to mention that these conditions had already been ruled out by other doctors. By that point, doctors were suspicious that Lacey might be displaying signs of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, but because they weren't certain, they didn't report it. Afterward, multiple providers said they wished they had put things together earlier, lamenting the missed opportunities to save Garnet. By the time anyone put the pieces of this intricate puzzle together, it would be too late. I'll stop here for this week. In part 2 next week, I'll tell you the rest of Garnet's story, including his brutal and untimely death and his mother's prosecution. Take care of yourselves, everyone. That's it for this week. Join me next week for part 2 of the story of Garnet Spears and my series on Munchausen syndrome by proxy. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music, and all music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildrenpod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.